Almost 2 years since I was last here, and it is a great pleasure to be back at this institute in this room talking about things which I hope are of interest to all of us. My subject this evening is religion and the meeting of civilizations. You will notice that I chose my words carefully. Meeting, not clash. Though, of course, the notion of a clash of civilizations is a familiar one, and one which I shall, of course, be bound to discuss in the course of my remarks. There are a couple of odd things, I think, about even this title and the subject I propose to discuss, one of which is the use of the plural. There was a time, until not so long ago, when civilization was a word only used in the singular. Civilization meant us and our way of doing things, and the rest were barbarians. And this was true of European Christendom, it was true of the Roman Empire, it was true of the Hellenistic world, it was true of China, and so on and so on. The notion that civilization is a noun which has a plural, that there may be different civilizations, either in succession or, more dangerously, in coexistence, is a comparatively modern one. I suppose the first major exponent of that was Spengler. There have been others since. Religion is a word with a slightly different history. That did have a plural in a rather remote past, with the easy tolerance of polytheists for each other's religions. But with the rise of monotheism, it became more difficult. And religion, like civilization, came to be a word with only a singular in common usage. Just as civilization meant us and the rest were barbarians, religion meant our way of belief and practice and the rest are infidels. There are two words, I think, convenient words, which I propose to use to describe two basic attitudes to this question of, shall we say, religious pluralism. And the two words are relativism and triumphalism. Both of these originally came into use as terms of abuse. They were used not so much to describe, rather to denounce an approach to religion which the users of these words disapprove. But they are convenient, they are familiar, and I propose to use them, and let me hasten to add, without necessarily injecting into their use any negative content or intentions. There is a rather interesting episode in the papers published now regarding a famous figure well known in this city, St. John of Capistrano, very much opposed, shall we say, to religious relativism, and very strong in his denunciation of Jews and Muslims, which he expressed by, shall we say, promoting pogroms and crusades against the one and against the other, in accordance with the normal practice of the time. St. John of Capistrano made many accusations against both Jews and Muslims, most of which are, shall we say, exaggerated or even unfounded. But on one point about the Jews, he was absolutely right. In one of his sermons, he says, "The Jews harbor the preposterous belief that every man can be saved, can achieve salvation in his own religion, which," says the saint, "is manifestly absurd." This was not a false accusation. The Jews do indeed have, and have long had, such a belief. In the Talmud it says quite explicitly that the righteous of all communities have a place in heaven. Presumably except those who don't believe in heaven, but that's not... that's my own gloss. And there is also the story that before the Ten Commandments, which were revealed to Moses, there were seven commandments revealed at an earlier date to Noah, and therefore, obviously, in the entire human race. And these are simpler and fewer than the ten, and contain only two theological commandments. One God, no idols. If one accepted those two, one was, shall we say, okay within the fold. This kind of relativism has a long history, and it was once normal, as I remarked earlier. For polytheists, there is no problem. I have my God, you have your God. When I visit your city, I will offer a sacrifice to your God. When you visit my city, you offer a sacrifice to my God. But this kind of polytheistic tolerance did not survive the universal acceptance, or almost universal acceptance, at least in the parts of the world with which we are familiar, of monotheist doctrines. The relativist view, I think, is becoming familiar again at the present time through the numerous ecumenical movements, the attempt to bring exponents of different faiths together to find common ground and to stop denouncing each other as unbelievers. It's hard going, and it's had so far far more success in the Western world than anywhere else. The relativist view, I would put it this way, that religions are like languages. Just as the human race has evolved, just as men have evolved different languages to speak to each other, so they have evolved different religions to speak to God. For me, English is the one true language. But it would be absurd for me to insist that English is the true language and therefore all other languages are false. The relativist view would be that the same is true of religion. That, of course, is anathema to the triumphalists. Now, the triumphalist view is that of those who claim that their religion is not only universal, but exclusively so. That their truths, that is to say, are not only universal, that is claimed by all religions, but that they alone are the fortunate possessors of God's total and final revelation to humanity. The first universal religion, I suppose, was Buddhism. But that has long ceased to have the same kind of worldwide appeal and program of expansion that is characteristic of both Christianity and Islam. For Christians and Muslims, theirs, as I said, is the total and final truth of God, of which they are the fortunate recipients and custodians, and which it is therefore their divinely imposed duty to bring to the rest of mankind. It would be selfish and unworthy if they failed to do this. This gives rise to a number of interesting consequences. Because of these shared attitudes, Christianity and Islam have an enormous amount in common. There is, of course, a great deal of common material in the Judaic, Hellenistic, and Middle Eastern background. There are also these shared beliefs which give rise to shared attitudes, shared purposes, and all too often shared methods. What I want to do in the rest of my talk today is to look at some of these shared, some of the things in which they resemble each other and some in which they are different. The triumphalist attitude was well summed up a number of years ago by an American Catholic writer who said that he was asked in a television interview what he had derived from his strictly religious education, parochial school, parochial university, and so on. And he said the message could be expressed in three short, simple sentences. I'm right, you're wrong, go to hell. As a summary of, shall we say, traditional religious education and of traditional attitudes to the followers of other religion, it is, shall we say, not too bad. It meant that in the great debates in the Middle Ages, the disputations, as they were called, Christians and Muslims could argue meaningfully. Even though they differed, they had enough common ground to argue. It was possible in medieval Spain, for example, to arrange public disputations between Christians and Muslims, sometimes also with Jews. And this could happen because of sufficient shared ground. When a Christian or a Muslim said to the other, "You are an infidel and you will burn in hell," each knew exactly what the other meant, because they meant the same thing. Their heavens are rather different, but their hells are strikingly similar. This kind of debate would have been impossible between either a Christian or a Muslim on one side and, shall we say, a Buddhist or a Confucian on the other. There would have been no basis for communication, no possibility of dialogue, even of hostile dialogue. I said that there are these two religions, similar attitudes, similar purposes, similar beliefs, and we must add to that close to each other geographically, leading, of course, to conflict. I suppose I should mention, not as a possibility, a third religion, and that is communism, which for a while operated in ways strikingly similar to those of the two world religions, with a similar belief in its universal possession of the truth, its similar belief in a mission to bring this truth by propaganda or by conquest to the rest of the world, and a Soviet subject, I choose my words carefully, of Muslim origin, conveniently summed this up in what he said was the communist Marxist creed. You know the Muslim creed, of course. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet of Allah. He said the communist creed is there is no God, and Karl Marx is his prophet. But for purposes of my present discussion, I don't propose to include the communists, but to limit myself to the two religions. Now, let me look at their attitudes to each other, to Judaism, common background of the two, and also to other religions which are not Judaic, not Christian, not Muslim. All agree in totally rejecting polytheism and atheism. These are out, they are not to be tolerated at all. Otherwise, in the relations between these religions, the crucial issue is before or after. For Christians, Judaism is a predecessor. For Christians, Christianity comes as the fulfillment of promises made to the Jews. And this fulfillment is rejected by the Jews, who suffer from it in consequence. But the Jewish revelation, when it came, was authentic and is incorporated in the Bible, which is also the Christian Bible, where it is called the Old Testament. Jews, of course, do not call it the Old Testament, because that presumes there is a New Testament. Islam, on the other hand, from a Christian point of view, is a subsequent religion. Now, a previous religion may be superseded, it may be outdated, it may even have been falsified by its unworthy custodians, but it is in its origins an authentic faith. A subsequent religion, subsequent, that is to say, to God's final revelation to mankind, is of necessity false. The same, by the way, may be true of heresy, and there are some attempts in the Middle Ages to explain Islam as a Christian heresy. Not as silly as you may at first think. There's a wonderful story about how Muhammad was a Roman cardinal who was angry at being passed over in a papal election, and in a fit of spite went off to Arabia to start a new religion. That did not have a very wide following, but it does occur in some texts. The main point is that they, being subsequent, it had to be false. Now, from a Muslim point of view, Christianity, like Judaism, is a predecessor. And therefore, in the same way as Judaism for Christians, so Christianity and Judaism for Muslims represent, shall we say, last year's model. Something which was all right at the time, which did represent an authentic revelation of God's message, a fulfillment of God's purpose, but which went wrong, which was in one way or another corrupted by its unworthy custodians, and therefore needed to be replaced by the latest, best, and again, final version of God's word. There are a number of passages in the Quran which clearly indicate this. I don't know how many of you have ever been to Jerusalem. There is a very famous building there which is known incorrectly as the Mosque of Omar. It isn't the Mosque of Omar. It was built rather later than Omar. Its correct name is the Dome of the Rock. And it dates from the late 7th century. That is to say, the 1st century of Islam. And there are a number of inscriptions inside the dome and on the walls. Most of them verses from the Quran. And the choice of verses is very interesting. There is the Quranic verse, for example, which says, God is one, one alone, he has no companion. Clearly an anti-Christian polemic. Or another verse, even more explicit, God is one, he does not beget, he is not begotten. This was part of the, how shall I put it, the self-assertion of a new religion, a new revelation, a new message, and incidentally, a new empire, confronting Byzantium, confronting Christendom, and saying, in effect, move over, now we're here. It was easier, therefore, for Muslims to tolerate its predecessors than for Christians to tolerate a subsequent religion. Muslims show the same angry intolerance when they confront a successor religion, such as, for example, the Baha'i religion, which developed in Iran in the 19th century. That, from the Muslim point of view, was an abomination, because while something previous to Muhammad can be tolerated, something subsequent to Muhammad is necessarily false and destructive. Let me mention briefly the question of disagreement within the religion. The two Christian notions of schism and heresy. Now, Muslims often disagreed on their religion, but interestingly, they did not develop a concept of heresy. The modern Arabic word for heresy is hartaka, which is obviously a loan word from Latin or possibly from French. It doesn't exist in classical Arabic. If you look in the classical texts, you will find the names of hundreds of heresies, but nothing that corresponds to the word heresy. The fact of difference of belief, of doctrine, of practice existed and was acknowledged. But the notion of such a category as heresy or schism did not exist. And I suppose that the main reason for that is the lack in Islam of ecclesiastical institutions. Muhammad, unlike his predecessors, triumphed in his own lifetime. He was not put to death, it was his enemies who were put to death. He established a state, he ruled it. He did what rulers normally do in the state which he founded in Medina. So it was not necessary, as it was for Christians during the first centuries of Christian history, to create separate institutions of their own. So there is no equivalent to the church in Islam. The equivalent of the church is the mosque in the sense of a building, a place of worship. But the equivalent of the church as an organization does not exist. Or rather, I correct myself, did not exist until fairly recently. Now, what we have seen in the Islamic Republic of Iran is the Christianization of Iran, of Islam. Christianization in the institutional sense, not practice, not doctrine, but institutionally, for the first time, they have introduced ecclesiastical hierarchy and authority. And thanks to Khomeini and his successors, Iran now has, for the first time in Islamic history, a pope, a college of cardinals, a bench of bishops, and most active of all, an inquisition. I have no doubt that in due course they will also have a reformation. In fact, there are signs of it already. Between these two clearly religiously defined civilizations, there are certain differences. I do not include Judaism as a civilization. Judaism is certainly a religion and a religious culture and a predecessor in a very real sense of both Christianity and Islam. But I don't think one can speak of a Jewish civilization as one speaks of a Christian or a Muslim civilization. The Jews were too few and too fragmented. Most of diaspora Jewish history has taken place either in the Christian world or in the Muslim world. There were Jewish communities in India and China, but they are very small and without significance either in the history of those countries or in the history of the Jews. We have got accustomed at the present time to speak of the Judeo-Christian tradition, a term which dates from the late 20th century, and which in earlier times was not used and would have been found equally offensive on both sides of the hyphen. But it's now common usage. We do not talk of the Judeo-Islamic tradition, but one could do so with equal historical justification. Jews were, shall we say, a subculture, an important one, an active one, a creative one, within the larger Christian civilization on the one hand and Muslim civilization on the other. And here again I would like to make a parenthesis. There's a good deal of talk in modern Israel about differences between Sephardic Jews and Ashkenazic Jews, or between Afro-Asian Jews and Euro-American Jews. But it isn't really that at all. If one looks closely, one, I think, must recognize that this inner cultural conflict within Israel is between the Christian Jews and the Muslim Jews, using these adjectives not in a religious but in a civilizational sense. Now, the Jews of Christendom, who came from Christian countries and bringing with them a whole set of beliefs, attitudes, practices, and the like, and those who came from Muslim countries with an equivalent set from Islam. And here again, I suppose I should add the third possibility, those who came from the former Soviet Union and its dependencies and bring with them Soviet culture, from which may the Lord of all three religions preserve us.